You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Elle and Dakota Fanning on the cover. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Now, here's the editor's letter from Mark Guiducci, Global Editorial Director, with photograph by Tyler Mitchell. As I write this, the FBI is raiding the home and office of John Bolton in what would seem to be a follow-through on President Donald Trump's campaign pledge for retribution. In another era, this might be a whole week's news cycle, but in 2025, we know that there will be some other onslaught tomorrow, maybe even later today. 7 months into his second administration, Trump has not yet fulfilled other promises, including to make America affordable again, or turn the United States into a manufacturing superpower. But he has sought to deliver karmic justice to those he considers his tormentors. Besides Bolton, the administration has opened investigations into Miles Taylor, Letitia James, Adam Schiff, and Barack Obama, all while amping up the police state in policy and pomp from sea to shining sea. Call it muzzle velocity, or shock and awe, or perhaps call it show business. There are lights, cameras, and action. There is even stage makeup. Trump is, among other qualities, a very effective drama queen. Certainly, chess director Michael Meyer took into consideration the drama of current Russo-American relations when he decided to restage the cult classic musical. Set to a score by ABBA, Chess pitches a Bobby Fischer-inspired character against a Russian grandmaster at the height of the Cold War, and will this month return to Broadway with a new book for the first time since its notorious New York opening in 1988. Intensifying everything that happens on stage is the real-world context of ongoing Ukrainian peace deal negotiations, a precedent-exploding summit in Alaska with Vladimir Putin, quickly followed by a redux of the Oval Office beratement of Volodymyr Zelensky, who was this time phalanxed by more than a half-dozen world leaders, and a suit. Let's not look to ABBA to forecast where things are headed for the Donbas, but the fear and emotion and unpredictability, as chess writer Danny Strong says, of the Cold War, all resonate. When I arrived at Vanity Fair, staff writer Chris Murphy was underway, reporting another tale from the theater world, this month's profile of multi-hyphenate iconoclast Jeremy O. Harris. I first met Harris in November 2018, when I attended Slave Play, still off-Broadway, but already a cause célèbre. By curtain call, I decided to meet him. Who had these twisted ideas? All of us, he might say. I tracked him down in the lobby of the Bowery Hotel, where we sat for hours that night, and he's been a friend ever since. Jeremy has this gift of venturing into the shadows on our behalf, actor Kaya Gerber told Chris. He says the things out loud that most of us are too ashamed to even think. Harris has a wave of new projects unfurling, including another run of Prince Faggot, a Harris-produced play that upholds his preternatural tendency for controversy. In Slave Play, the second act delivers. I hope for the sake of culture that Harris's own next act is just as strong. Neither Trump nor Harris would appreciate this comparison, but they both know the power of provocation. Governor Gavin Newsom, too. Other Democrats, take note. Here are some of the contributors to the issue. Inez and Vinod, sibling rivalry. Photographers Inez and Vinod have watched Dakota and Elle Fanning grow up in front of their camera. But until this cover shoot, the duo had never photographed the sisters together. They have both become such great women, great actors, the photographers say, and stay curious about all aspects of life. Terrence Connors, Grind Mode. Connors has been photographing skateboarders since he was a teenager in New York. Skating downtown became my way into the city and into fashion, he says. To return to those same streets with a camera in hand, now on assignment, felt like a quiet kind of homecoming. Savannah Walsh, sibling rivalry. Walsh joined Vanity Fair as an editorial assistant in 2021. Now a staff writer, she found that while writing about Dakota and Elle Fanning, the piece morphed into not only a showcase for the Fannings' unbreakable bond, but a love letter to my own little sister, Sierra. Michelle Ruiz, The Price of Infamy. I've always wanted to tell this story, and I'm also really happy to have my friend back, says Ruiz. After almost 30 years, the writer reunited with her childhood pal, Jesse Buttafuoco, for days of interviews during which they revisited the lasting impact of the tabloid scandal that once engulfed her family. I learned about reporting on crime with care, says Ruiz. Tyler Mitchell, The Greatest Showman. Mitchell calls Jeremy O. Harris one of his closest friends. I feel fortunate to have photographed him at this moment in both his journey and my own. Aperture recently published Wish This Was Real, a survey of the photographer's work. Now this from Rebecca Ford with photographs by Johnny Marlowe. Odessa Young, the semi-nomadic Springsteen obsessive and recovering indie darling, is living her dream, starring as the boss's muse opposite Jeremy Allen White. Ask Odessa Young what she does for a living, and she might not say she's an actor, especially when she's doing this, chatting with a journalist over breakfast at the Cine Sunset Tower. Young is makeup-free, wearing a simple white T-shirt, comfortable black pants, and some delicate jewelry. She's been curled up in a booth by the pool, soaking up her last few hours in Los Angeles before going back to set, where she'll feel like a real actor again. Young has been acting professionally since she was 11 years old and delivering daring work in art house dramas since her breakout performance in the bloody, provocative 2018 slasher Assassination Nation. Odessa is fearless, gutsy, and raw, says her Assassination co-star Hari Neff. She looks like an ingenue, but doesn't act like one. That contrast is magnetic. These projects have cast the native Australian opposite many of the Internet's current boyfriends, including Logan Lerman in Shirley, Josh O'Connor in Mothering Sunday, and Jacob Elordi in The Narrow Road to the Deep North. Next, she's playing Jeremy Allen White's muse in Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, out in October. As her first studio movie, it's a major step up for Young and a much bigger spotlight. No longer an indie darling, the 27-year-old says with a smirk. As a chameleonic actor, she's a bit uneasy with the idea of potentially getting a lot of attention for this role. Young admits she's still navigating what the film could mean for her career, but intends to keep taking measured steps, as she has from the start. Nothing has ever happened quickly for me, and I think that's for a very good reason, she says. It means that I have become more and more solidified in what I actually want. The soundtrack to Young's life is Bruce Springsteen. Though Young was raised in Sydney, her parents, her father is a musician, and her mother is a writer, were big fans of the boss. When I listened to his music, I was hearing the story of my family, she says, so I had been completely and utterly obsessed with him for most of my life. After some success on Australian TV shows and films, Young dropped out of her performing arts high school. She moved to Los Angeles 2 days after her 18th birthday, living with her agent's co-worker's assistant. I was really young, and I felt older than I could ever feel again in my life, she says. With that naivete comes the sort of confidence that's only possible when you're 18. I had metal skin. There was nothing touching me. She spent a few years in Los Angeles before moving to New York, where she still lives. But wherever she goes, Springsteen comes along. Give me a scenario, I'll give you a song, Young says, when asked about his influence on her. At one of her lower points, she listened to Drive All Night on repeat. But Springsteen's 1978 album, Darkness on the Edge of Town, is her favorite. When she heard that a Springsteen movie was in the works, Young told her agents to get her a role, any role at all. Though Young got an audition, she was pretty sure she botched the self-tape. It's corny, but there was nothing else that mattered in that moment, she says. In her despair, she escaped New York, renting a converted school bus for a weekend in New Jersey, which is, of course, Springsteen's ancestral homeland. She also wrote director Scott Cooper a letter revealing her lifelong connection to the musician. I explained that it had been such a privilege to even make the tape in general and be a part of the audition process, Young says. I was so excited to see the movie no matter what happened, whether I was a part of it or not. A few weeks later, she was offered the part of Springsteen's love interest. Single Mom Faye is a fictional character, an amalgamation of some of the women in his life as he was writing his 1982 album, Nebraska. Her stillness and her ability to communicate volumes with her eyes are real strengths, says Cooper of Young. She can convey a whole spectrum of emotions, sorrow, defiance, hope, without saying a word. With her first studio movie, Young will have to accept aspects of being an actor she's largely resisted so far. The press, the promotion, the commodification. I find gifting sweets just anxiety-inducing. The junkets are so stressful, she says. She's somehow not even on Instagram. I do think that it is a tool of warfare, basically, at this point in our existence. Though Young lives in the East Village with her husband, director David Raiboy, they met on their 2019 movie, The Giant, and dogs Slim Jim and Hank. Her restlessness pulls her to a more nomadic lifestyle. I'm probably not supposed to have a place that I live 100% of the time, she says. Luckily, she's also an actor, with plenty of opportunities to travel for roles, provided she's finally ready to call herself one. Here's a chart by Chris Black. Are you high bro or low bro? You've probably noticed the term bro being thrown around a lot more lately, whether it's hey bro, the interchangeable bruh, or bromance. The endless discussion around the power of the manosphere has firmly placed the term back in the lexicon. It has to be seen as a slight, a descriptor for a particular kind of guy who liked sports, drank domestic canned beer, worked in finance, and may have dabbled in some misogynistic views. He graduated from an Ivy League school or scraped by at an ACC or SEC state school. That style of lowbro is a bit of a relic. He has been dethroned by the highbro. Today's sleek, updated version is more culturally aware, curious, well-read, and evolved. It's okay for a highbro to care about fashion, movies, music, and books, while still happily partaking in sports gambling and annual fishing trips. He lives an urbane and interesting lifestyle, drinks espresso martinis with his gay friends, watches Bravo, and goes to therapy, but still pays extra for the NFL Red Zone package. It's a step in the right direction. Now here's the lowbro. Residential neighborhood, far Upper West Side, gym, Equinox, all access, media must, DraftKings, daily uniform, Lululemon ABC classic fit trouser, preferred form of protein, steak, rare, grocery store, Whole Foods, style icon, David Beckham, podcast, This Past Weekend with Theo Van, movie, Top Gun Maverick, scent, Tom Ford, Tuscan leather, business hotel, Four Seasons Hotel, New York downtown, breakfast order, TRT in Celsius, lunch spot, Cava, libation, dirty martini with blue cheese olives, extra cold, dinner spot, regular, the corner store, dinner spot with your bros, Peter Luger Steakhouse, car, Rivian truck, status gift, natural wine, dating app, Raya Plus, protein powder, ProMix, vacation spot, the Miami Beach edition. Now for the highbro, residential neighborhood, Tribeca, gym, Forma Pilates, media must, Feed Me, daily uniform, vintage Levi's 501, preferred form of protein, rotisserie chicken, grocery store, Happier Grocer, style icon, Jeremy Allen White, podcast, How Long Gone, which I co-host with Jason Stewart, movie, Top Gun Maverick, scent, Pareto 1996, business hotel, the Greenwich Hotel, breakfast order, homemade overnight oats with organic berries, lunch spot, the Odeon, libation, Mezcal Negroni, dinner spot, regular, Torisi, dinner spot with your bros, Thai diner, car, Land Rover Defender, status gift, low and large tomato leaves candle, dating app, Instagram DM, protein powder, cachava, vacation spot, golden eye. Grind Mode. Valentino Garavani collaborates with Vans on six limited edition styles designed to kick-push your way into high fashion. Edited by Daisy Shaw Ellis with photograph by Terrence Connors. Nuts and Bolts. Creative director Alessandro Michel's interest in skateboarding culture spans at least a decade. This marks his second collaboration with Vans. Vans originally launched its signature checkerboard print as a permanent way to emulate a design that skaters drew on their shoes. The shoes made their debut during Valentino's Fall-Winter 2025 show, held in a recreation of a public bathroom in Paris, which immediately grounded the fanciful clothes in reality. The Valentino Garavani and Vans collaboration reinterprets a hallmark motif from both names, the chat de la maison, the cat of the house, for the former, and the traditional checkerboard, for the latter. Available at Valentino Boutiques. Now, this from Daniela Tijerina with photographs by O.K. McCausland, Mark Ronson. The Oscar-winning songwriter and producer documents a bygone era of New York in his new memoir. The genesis of the book really came to life here, says Mark Ronson, towering over his collection of VMAs, Grammys, a Golden Globe, and an Oscar in his sun-drenched West Village home office. In Night People, published by Grand Central, Ronson offers a snapshot of 90s New York City, reflecting on a time before he was halfway to an EGOT, hustling and spinning vinyl in clubs. These days, his evenings sound a little different. She likes to bang on the piano, he says of his toddler, or I'll play piano while she's on the floor with her toys. In the photos, Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential, Ronson says, is the best book ever about working in New York at night. His reading diet while working on his own book also included Mary Carr's The Art of Memoir and Stephen King's On Writing. Soul to Soul, brilliant British R&B, have a song called Back to Life that was such a club classic when I started DJing. I've started playing vinyl again as a result of the book, he says. This new era of DJing has been me hunting down old treasures. Above his Ojas custom record player hangs a 2020 Willem Sosnall portrait of saxophonist Ornette Coleman. Arting his Steinway upright, a 2015 George Condo portrait of Ronson from his mother, and Dexter Jones, a drawing of the blues group James Brown and the Famous Flames from his manager, Brandon Creed, and Uptown Funk icon drafts by Brian Redinger. I wrote most of the Barbie score on that piano, he says. I also meditate here. Charm to Table by Nate Freeman, with photographs by Caroline Tompkins. The 26-year-old chef, Flynn McGarry, has been wowing diners for more than a decade. His most ambitious project yet promises fully-fledged escapism. New York chef Flynn McGarry spent a summer preparing to launch a highly anticipated fine dining restaurant called Cove, which opens this month on Houston Street in West Soho. But for a big chunk of June and July, he did that prep from luscious rural fields on Long Island, shuttling between town and country and occasionally making constructive decisions while multitasking. On Friday, I was out here literally cutting lobsters open on FaceTime, he said, being like, put the tile there. It was a Saturday in July, and McGarry was walking through Isabella Rossellini's 28-acre Mama Farm in Brookhaven through the pens of chickens and cows and chirping birds. Since putting down roots there to grow herbs and vegetables for Cove, he's gotten so tight with the dozens of goats that he was on a first-name basis with at least one of them. That's Gertrude Stein, he said, pointing. But he wasn't out there to hang with livestock. Rossellini, who founded the farm in 2013, invited McGarry to set up shop on her property in March after befriending him at Jim, his former restaurant in the city. Through the summer, he tested menus for Cove, staging ambitious multi-course extravaganzas served in plein air at dusk with no light but the setting sun, dessert arriving as darkness settled in. The dinners were small, a dozen people each night, including his girlfriend, Amanda Lee Burkett, and on one occasion, Alec Baldwin. The guest list for Cove's splashy opening was under wraps at press time, but other devotees of McGarry's cooking include Dries Van Noten, Daniel Boulud, and Maria Sharapova. And one of his backers is Danny Meyer's Shake Shack investor, George Laning. McGarry wants his team to spend a lot of time on the farm and bottle the energy so it can be felt even when you're sitting for a tasting menu in the middle of Manhattan. There's trees, there's water, it's everywhere, he said. We'll bring our cooks out here. You become so thirsty for it. In the photos, Good to Grow, Flynn McGarry works with edible marigolds at Mama Farm. A Cove menu. Dishes from McGarry's former restaurant, Jim, wine, a blueprint for Cove, an interior from Jim Wine. Cove is McGarry's first big-budget, super snazzy, going-for-four-sparklers restaurant. While on paper, which on paper is wildly impressive, he's just 26, well short of the age when most chefs graduate from grunt work to starter concept to the big leagues. But McGarry's actually a decade and a half into his career, having gotten his start as a pint-sized 12-year-old who went viral for his YouTube cooking displays and got a profile in The New Yorker with the headline Prodigy. He opened the small but ambitious Forsyth Street spot, Jim, in 2018, and then followed it with a wine bar nearby, all before he could legally drink. They've since closed, but he maintains Jim Home, a cookware store and pantry that traffics in items like vintage teapots, tableware, and McGarry's homemade spice mixes and savory granola, and sells pleasingly creative sandwiches and salads during the day. And now, with Cove, he has a space where he can punch up to the iconic restaurants that he wants to emulate, the French Laundry, Chez Panisse, the River Cafe. But on that night in July, there was no external budding restaurateur stress, just the green farm and the enormous red sky and the cavalcade of herb-forward knockout dishes that could one day end up at Cove. Chilled cucumber soup with nasturtium, Montauk tuna with tomatoes and verbena, lobster glazed with sour plum, served with new potatoes cooked in lobster brains. And it sure is nice to have a place like Mama Farm. While running the tasting menu iteration of Jim, McGarry told me he needed some pine branches and had to spend $60 a bundle for them in the flower district. Here, he can pick them up off the ground. Once the restaurant opens, he'll truck in hauls of fresh veggies that he can plate that night. Everyone wants that feeling of like I'm escaping, he said. For Cove, I can say, this was picked this morning, and it's right on a leaf that we also picked this morning. Chaos theory. Mitchell Jackson, a once-canceled journalist, is comfortable with controversy, his own and that of his incendiary clients, by Natalie Korach. Opening photo, spin cycle. Mitchell Jackson in New York City's Duane Park in July takes calls anywhere and everywhere, even during a Broadway play. Mitchell Jackson arrived at the Odeon 10 minutes early for our photo shoot, getting out of his Uber with headphones on for a phone call. With a large coffee in hand and an L.L. Bean tote bag embroidered with canceled over his shoulder, the PR strategist and crisis consultant took a lap around the block. finishing his phone call privately before meeting in front of the Tribeca restaurant. "I hate this," he says of the attention, before politely introducing himself to the photographer, whom he towered over in black Doc Martens boots. Being in front of the camera and the subject of a story is uncomfortable for Jackson. A self-described interloper, the 33-year-old PR pro is accustomed to working behind the scenes on behalf of high-profile and provocative clients, such as Candace Owens, Brett Cooper, Adam Friedland, Caroline Calloway, and Adam 22. "I gravitate toward clientele that have something to say, because otherwise I'd be bored," Jackson tells me, adding, "The idea of working with Pod Save America makes me want to gouge my eyes out." Jackson occupies a unique space in today's combustible internet news cycle, where reams of outrage can cut short a budding media career or propel one to new heights. A journalist once canceled for consorting with members of the far-right media with a voting record that includes backing Ron DeSantis and Joe Biden. Jackson is thriving in the chaos that comes with repping conservative podcasters and contrarian comedians while also managing various A-list crises. Though he generally sticks to the shadows, a recent New York Times profile of Cooper, the conservative YouTube star and Fox News contributor, noted how her publicist had enticed a whole row of reporters to watch her perform at a New York comedy club earlier this year. "I was one of them, and in dealing with Jackson regarding various personalities, I've become accustomed to his frenetic fashion, rushing from one meeting to another, almost always on the phone. We were at a Broadway show once, and he left his seat multiple times during the performance to field calls. Sitting down for lunch at the Odeon, he was just as efficient, immediately ordering a water, an Earl Grey tea, and a cappuccino at the server's first appearance. Do the gotchas first," he says, "when I turn my phone on to record the conversation. I used to save them for the end when I was a reporter," Jackson continues, referencing his past. "You'd wait till the end to ask Rachel Dolezal if she's white." "I don't have any gotcha questions," I laugh, making a mental note to ask Jackson if there's anyone that has gone too far for even him to consider working with. Prior to his PR business, BCC Communications, Jackson wrote about some divisive characters for Vice, including Dolezal, Ann Coulter, and Paris Hilton. "I think all of my clients are people I would have covered," he says. As both a reporter and a PR strategist, Jackson benefited, in his words, from being a little tismy, and as a result being particularly blunt. "I think it actually opens people up more. I'm not judgmental." He says Vice was more permissive than media outlets today, allowing or even encouraging an immersive gonzo journalism style. "We slept at the Bunny Ranch. I slept at the Sausage Castle. There was stuff I did at Vice that I did not want to do," he says. "I was there from 20 to 25, having started working for the media company while still attending Sarah Lawrence College," Jackson recounts. "I was a baby." One of the things Jackson is referring to, which he says his boss has permitted, ultimately led to his firing from the company and a full-scale media cancellation. In October 2017, Jackson, whose last name was then Sunderland, he took his husband's last name after getting married, was outed by BuzzFeed for being part of a long-running email chain created to mock the early stages of the woke movement on the internet. The group included far-right activist Milo Yiannopoulos, once a Breitbart editor. "Please mock this fat feminist," one unearthed email read from Jackson to Yiannopoulos in reference to a Times columnist. "I drove traffic, whether that was me, with my boss's permission, sending opposition media our story so they'd make fun of them, or I had a good instinct for what would sell," Jackson says. The day after the BuzzFeed story was published, Vice fired Jackson. That era when he left Vice was such a different time culturally, says independent journalist Taylor Lorenz, who has known Jackson since his time at Vice and covers many of his current clients. I actually think if that scandal had happened now, I don't think he would have lost his job or been pushed out. Conservative media would rally around something like that. While the emails ultimately cost Jackson his job, he saw a cultural shift in the works. There was a mind virus in 2017 where everyone thought the world was going, Jackson says, using a catchphrase beloved by the likes of Elon Musk. Anyone who has read American history or American pop culture history would have known that woke was never going to last forever. He argues that while it was partially a gut instinct to lean into his cancellation and away from woke trends, it is also the cycle of American pop culture dating back to P.T. Barnum. Controversy and irreverence have always been what works, Jackson says. Some people have accused me of being part of the degradation of Western culture or whatever, which I take as a compliment, Jackson says, of his second career in communications. I'm not a Svengali. I'm not a puppet master. I'm just practical in responding to what works. It's like, okay, I got canceled. I need to work. Practical. Jackson's business is referral only, and he has amassed an impressive client list, which he in part attributes to his ability to maintain long-standing relationships. Jackson first met Calloway a decade ago after assigning a story about her Instagram presence. The two kept in touch until Jackson was fired from Vice, and he says Calloway stopped speaking to him. She later apologized, and they made amends, he says, with Jackson advising Calloway on the release of her self-published book, Scammer. Years earlier, Calloway had been reeling from the fallout of backing out of her book deal, a former friend taking credit for editing her Instagram captions and co-writing her book proposal, and hosting a series of live events that drew comparisons to Fyre Festival. I did push Caroline, he says, to publish her book at the same time as one by Natalie Beach, who claimed to be Calloway's ghostwriter. Calloway tells me that while Jackson did suggest the timeline, it didn't change her plans whatsoever, considering there was no world in which I would have let her book come out before mine, so we were already on the same page before he said anything. Mitchell made a brief cameo in Lily Annalick's 2023 profile of Calloway for Vanity Fair. For this story, I ask Calloway about her relationship with Jackson, which she says, after being friends for a decade, there is no one whose perspective on media I value more. Jackson says it's definitely a collaboration, adding that Calloway is good at handling press on her own as well. She would have been a good publicist, honestly. I think Candace would be a great publicist also, he added. Owens, Jackson says, has a very clear vision when it comes to content. She follows her interest. Every day it's a surprise what the show is going to be. That's the fun of it, he says. What people don't understand about Candace is that her audience is millennial moms. She has taken the place in the culture, like her show comes out at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard, which is the time Ricky Lake and Oprah used to be on, Jackson continues. She is daytime television for millennial moms. Jackson touted the recent coverage of Owens, including an appearance on Theo Vaughn's podcast and coverage in the Wall Street Journal, for being the number three podcast in downloads and views across platforms earlier this year, according to Podscribe. Those, to me, are wins, he says. There's people who look down on me or look down on this, but they write about it every day. Owen's success, of course, has come with its fair share of controversy, such as her 2024 suspension from YouTube about sharing an interview with Kanye West that included anti-Semitic content. More recently, in July, French President Emmanuel Macron and his wife Brigitte Macron filed a lawsuit against Owens for defamation over her conspiratorial claims about the couple, including that the First Lady of France was born a biological male. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. And again, you can look for these Vanity Fair podcast at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday.